I'm Ann Nicholson Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Today I'm talking to three Chicago theater critics: Carrie Reed, who's freelance for the Tribune and the Reader; Tony Adler, who's the arts editor at the Reader and in a previous life was a freelance writer himself; and Chris Jones, who's the chief theater critic at the Chicago Tribune. So welcome to you. I guess I'd like to just start by talking about what is the job of the critic. And maybe, Chris, you could just start talking about what you see as being your job. What are your obligations to your readers? What are your obligations to the artists you're reviewing? What are you trying to accomplish by writing a review of a play?
Well, I think you're trying to accomplish many often self-conflicting things. The bulk of my time is spent reviewing Chicago theater, picking what to review, and then reviewing it. And I think you can see the role of the review in many different ways. I write for a big general interest publication, so the principal person or persons I'm serving is the reader. And those readers themselves break down into several categories: the people who might go to the show if it's good, the people who are insiders who know the background of the show and are interested in it, and the vast bulk of them who will never go to the show no matter how much I like it. And the job of the review is to fulfill many different things. You have to provide an honest judgment as to what you think the show is, whether it's any good or not. You're a consumer guide, much like any other consumer guide, a newspaper, a restaurant reviewer, or something like that. And you're also providing to use a Hollywood phrase, coverage, which is to say that there are a lot of people who want to know what happened at Steppenwolf last night so they can not look like a fool at the water cooler the next day, mm-hmm. but will never go to Steppenwolf. And then in the end, I think you're also ideally trying to write a review that is in itself a piece of art that's worthy of, that stands on its own as a good piece of writing. So you're trying to do all of those things at once.
And you didn't say, which I guess in some ways surprised me, that you're providing some guidance to the artists as to whether they did what they set out to do, and maybe you don't see that as part of your job.
Well, I think the artists are part of the people you write for, but they're not the main part, at least not at my newspaper. But I think, ideally you write to be respected by the artists and by people in the theater community because they know the most about the show, and I think ideally you certainly want them to go, yes, he or she knows what they're talking about when they wrote that review. The extent to which you should be telling people how to change it is always, it's always open to debate. There's a number of different schools of thought on that. One is that you should always be sort of promoting improvement, and the other is that that's nonsense and not your job, and you should just see the show. You see the show, and you call it like you see it, and mm-hmm. it's a finished product, and that's it. My view on that is it depends on the show and where it is in its development and who's involved and various other factors. But the principal job is probably to evaluate more than to be – I don't necessarily think a review is under an obligation to be constructive.
Mm-hmm. I think a decent review implies constructive criticism in the sense that you – went there and tried to figure out, understand what was happening. And what you came away with, will tell them, if you can explain it clearly enough, it will help them understand what they've communicated.
Mm-hmm. Or failed to
communicate. At least to you.
Right. Well, do you have a different answer, Tony, about what you see the job of the reviews that are published in the Reader as being? Is there a difference because of the difference in the publications?
I think a lot of the criteria are the same. I think the Reader tries to be comprehensive. The Tribune tries to be comprehensive too. The Reader's readership is probably a little bit skewed, a little bit more specific than the Tribune's. So I think we assume a lot that can't be assumed at the Tribune about who we're talking to and what they might know and whether they'll go to the show. I don't have demographics on this, mm-hmm. but I would expect my reader at the Reader to be more sophisticated, to be a person who's much more likely to go to the theater, to go frequently, to know, you know, certain references, cultural references.
So it's a little more inside like baseball.
It's a luxury.
So, Carrie, do you have a different answer as someone who sees?
Well, I think since I review for both papers, it's kind of an amalgam of all of that. I also think there's a little bit of a repertorial function that comes into play for me because my early training was in journalism and not arts journalism per se, but I was, you know, thinking that I was going to be a beat reporter or something like that when I first started out. So there is that sense of trying to have an eye for detail, trying and probably failing more often than not to capture for an audience that is not there, as Chris was talking about, writing for people who may or may not ever see the show, what the experience of that show is in, at the moment that I'm seeing it, what's hitting home, what isn't quite there, what am I taking away, what, you know, those sorts of impressions, whether it's, you know, visual, oral, whatever it might be, to try to get a sense of, you know, the flavor or texture of a performance or of a show.
So to really evoke it. Well, let's go back to something that Chris raised, which was the question of how you decide what will be reviewed. And Carrie, that's probably not as relevant for you, but Tony, why don't you talk about how does it work at the Reader that a show does or doesn't get reviewed and by whom?
Well, the attempt is to review any professional work that that comes in that we know about. I don't know if we can always accomplish that. Part of it is purely geographical. If it's closer in, it's more to Chicago, it's more likely to get a review. There are certain shows that you are obligated to review because they're news. You know, whatever is part of the Goodman season or whatever is part of the Steppenwolf season, things like that. If I hadn't sent somebody to see Superior Donuts, I would be a bad assigner.
Right.
But there's also one of the things we want to do at the Reader is make sure that we support the storefront scene to get new companies reviewed to make sure that there are, you know, that we're seeing what's new.
How many reviewers do you assign to?
I think there are about a half dozen.
Okay. And how do you make any effort to match people with a particular show?
Well, I know what people prefer. You know, Bill Williams has begun musicals. He, as a senior critic, he gets lot more choices. So he, you know, he'll often pick a musical or people who like new plays or good at analyzing new plays. You know, I really appreciate Carrie because she'll, you know, she likes to go to the theater.
Seems like a good quality in everything, right? Well, have you run into the situation where you feel like a particular reviewer actually doesn't get certain types of plays, that they have blind spots?
Yes.
And then what do you do? And how do you form that opinion? Because you probably don't see all the shows. So what's your quality control?
I don't see all the shows, but I see all the reviews, and I see a lot of the shows.
So there's some way that you're matching your judgment of a show against your reviewers.
And there are certain tics that people come up with over time. And I don't want to go into those.
Well, I'm more interested in the question of how you make sure that a show is getting essentially a fair shake, someone who could be open to that kind of show. Well, do you feel like you have particular shows that, I mean, it's, before you go into something, you might decide that's really not going to be my cup of tea?
I think there have been one or two times where I feel like I've reviewed a playwright a lot in recent years and just haven't. They haven't clicked with me for whatever reason, so I may recuse myself from reviewing something else because I think it might be time for another critic to have a whack at it and see if they're seeing something there that I'm not getting something out of it that I don't. Partly, you know, that's to spare myself from seeing something that I think
find
I
annoying.
May not like based on past experience, but it's also to be fair to the producing organizations, and it's also to be fair to the publication. I think rightly or wrongly, a lot of people form ideas of what critics like. And mm-hmm. so they're, if you talk to people in the theater community, sometimes I'll hear a lot about, oh, well, that critic always hates
this kind
X, Y, and Z. Well, mm-hmm. up top of my head, I can think of several examples where they, in fact, really liked something from X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem that can sometimes develop, and this is probably something the signing editors should talk about more, is, well, you're always sending that guy, and he hates our work, so therefore we're never going to get a fair shake from this paper. You know, mm-hmm. that makes it kind of an issue of that there's some sort of, you know, shadowy hidden agenda in assigning, you know, somebody to a show. When in fact, I'm sure for you guys, it's just trying to plug the holes and get as much covered as possible.
Uh-huh. So. Well, Chris, obviously there's a certain cachet in getting a review from you, as opposed to somebody else on the paper. How do you decide which shows you're going to see?
I don't know about cachet. I do remember when I was Richard Christmas's backup that, you know, I would walk in and you'd see people's faces fall
right.
around. Do you remember that?
I thought it was just me.
And that's, you know, I've been on both sides of that. But, well, I try to go almost every night. You know, I do. I go 5 nights a week, I would say, perhaps a little less in the summer. But and certainly in the season, I go almost every night. And I try to do, like Tony pointed out, there are certain shows we have to cover, and we just do. So, well, yes, I'll be at, you know, Mamma Mia, or I'll be at, because a large number of our audience members are interested in those shows, and it drives some of the tiny theaters crazy because they don't value that kind of theater, but
right.
It's too bad. So we cover those, you know, we cover those important shows that are newsworthy. And we have a long tradition at the Tribune of no rules about not covering certain things. We cover non-equity theater, and if a show is good, it gets the same play even if it's from a storefront theater than it does at the Goodman. There's been lots of examples of that where we've run very big a review from a very small theater if it's good. Now, you know, there's only me, and then there's the fabulous freelance critics that we work with, principally Kerry and Nina Mess. And there's only so much room in the paper, and that's not getting any bigger. So there is there are hard choices to be made every week. I would say, in general, we try to do all the big shows. We try to do all the shows that we feel that we have to do. We try to cover Broadway. I go to many Broadway openings. We try to cover Stratford Festival, mm-hmm. The Suburban Theatres, Spring Green, the things in the region that people are interested in going to. A lot of Chicagoans travel to see theater. You know, in Stratford, for example, 30,000 people from here every year go there, mm-hmm. which is more than go to almost any theater in town.
Right.
So that's a good example of something we cover. And then we try to cover as many of the smaller theaters as we can. And certainly if Kerry or Nina has a particular interest in a company, that means they're more likely to get covered. But in general, we know what's going on. We read the reviews in the other publications, and we try to cover them as much as we can. I don't admit to any preference for any kind of theater. I really don't have any. I mean, people do ascribe that to critics, but it's not the case. There aren't theaters who are on our, you know, list of not to review. Certainly true that if I go to see a show at Theater X and it's terrible, it makes you less likely to go back to the next one. And mm-hmm. if you go to, conversely, if it's great, you're more likely to go to the next one. That's the way it is on that one, I think. I think it's probably the only prejudice I'd admit is probably a slight prejudice with smaller theaters doing original work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In favor of that.
Yes, in favor of that. Right. Because I think in general, if you see a theater doing a play that's been done already by many of the larger theaters and is essentially a group of very young people doing something that they just want to do to, you know, get their faces out there, that's probably less interesting to our readers, we think, or I think, than, you know, something new or progressive. We try to give family theater a lot of play. That's very important to our readers. And I have kids myself. I like going to family theater. So we do that. We try to cover as much as we can, and we cover more than almost any, I think we cover more than any daily paper in the country, with the exception of the New York Times.
Wow. That's impressive.
So we do. And and it's a fight to keep it there, but we so far, so good.
Well, what about, when you see a new play, a first production of a play that a script that isn't going to be known. Is that a different job than when you're seeing a production of a classic work? Maybe, Tony, do you have something to say about that? And if you're seeing, you know, yet another Hedda Gabler versus seeing a new script, is it a different way of analyzing? How do you separate out the qualities of the script from the qualities of the production, for instance?
We were talking about this at the event the other night. I'm not sure that I know the distinction. It may be that I just feel more open when I'm seeing something that I can't possibly have seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I have a certain my repertorial function probably kicks in more,
mm-hmm,
because
it's news. It's a new play.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I have more to record.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I, some people, they were talking the other night about people, seeing, reading the play beforehand. And I wouldn't do that. I think I would, I think part of the pleasure of seeing a new play would be seeing the new play in performance just then.
Right.
You know, after a certain number of years, you can, I hope you can, because I think I can, discern some of the distinctions between what's going on in a script and what's going on in a production.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, certainly it's easier if you see a production of Hamlet and something doesn't work, you're unlikely to blame Shakespeare. If you see a production of a new script and something doesn't work, then you say, well, could this have been pulled off in a different production, or is this a real playwright's problem? Carrie, you looked like you had something to say on that.
It's interesting because so much of what I see is in the smaller storefront. And I would say, all things being equal, we do, both for the reader and the Trib, tend to prioritize, as Chris pointed out, for new work or new companies or something that is fresh.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it gets a little bit into the context of the venue, and this can cut both ways. I've seen companies, certainly at the storefront level, who are attempting to do a script that really does require a certain level of production value that,
right,
it was just either not attainable by them or that they just didn't find a way to sort of get around that. At the same time, I've seen shows in larger theaters where I think, would I enjoy this more if it was in the storefront?
Yes.
Would there be a certain kind of intimacy and warmth or something in that setting that would translate better than it does when I'm sitting, you know, in an 800-seat proscenium where there's a little bit of a distance going on with these characters? I certainly feel at the very basic level, you know, if I'm seeing Hamlet, I hopefully don't have to tell anybody what happens in Hamlet. I think when I'm seeing a new play, and this did come up at the Director's Lab panel that Tony referenced that we were both at on Monday night, part of what I'm trying to find with a new work is a way for a potential audience to get a handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally I feel like maybe I fall into the trap of over comparing it to something else that's already out there. Mm-hmm. At the same time, that is a way
to help people
for an audience, you know, if it's reminiscent of Mamet or Neil LaBute or Sarah, mm-hmm, Rule or somebody like that, if I can bring that in, then at least that provides,
mm-hmm,
you know, like kind of a marker for somebody who says, wow, I really don't like Neil LaBute, I won't be seeing this play.
Right.
I'm sure it gets frustrating for new writers to feel that they're, you know, constantly being, you know, set up against these existing known quantities. But sometimes that's the only,
sure,
it's an imperfect yardstick, but it's some, mm-hmm, sort of yardstick for helping audiences, mm-hmm, who do not know this play and would not know this play because it's never been done before,
right,
to kind of get an idea of what they can expect.
One thing I just want to mention that, is that whether it's a new play or an old play, one of the great pleasures of being a critic and going to see a lot of theater, one of the pleasures of being an audience member is to be surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, that's so if it can happen anywhere, but the pleasure of surprise is one of the things you hope for. So you don't, you know, we were talking before about certain things we may try to avoid. I think we're in a good position in a way, being compelled to see certain things because it improves our chances of being surprised.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're surprised by a new play, you're surprised by a new approach to an old play.
There is, though, I would think, a danger in that interest in novelty that's particularly going to be true for someone who's seen a ton of theater, like like you all, that you may become a little jaded, and just a really great straight-up production of a well-known play, which could be of great value to someone who's never seen that play, is of less interest to you. Is there a way that you can kind of correct for that in the reviewing that you do, maybe Chris?
Well, it's a fair point. I'm guilty of that. You know, it is true that if you've seen a play five times and then you're seeing it in Oak Brook, you're seeing a play like, Arthur Coppett Phantom, I just reviewed in Munster, Indiana, which I'd just seen it less than a year ago in Chicago. But they hadn't seen it in Munster, and those people hadn't seen it. And
right.
You got to try and get past that.
Right. Because that's one of the things about theater, is that it has to be, every play has to be reproduced for every generation and in every locality. It's completely limited to its time and place. So,
well, you know, there are shows, there are theaters where older plays in New York, for example, you often get revivals of plays that feel like they have a point, like there's a point of view. Mm-hmm. And then you get, in Chicago, you get that too, but you also get people just doing the same play, I think, more here as a showcase themselves. And that's mm-hmm. what's less interesting
mm-hmm.
if they're not appropriate for that play or they don't have a particular reason for doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I've had that debate with someone specifically about Stratford, that you go and you see, you know, pretty often very straightforward productions of great plays. And does the director have to bring some new cool twist to it, or is it enough that this generation of audiences in this place get to see a really good incarnation of a really good script?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one. I think ideally there's always a strong point of view.
Mm-hmm. Because it will actually be better, not just different,
yeah,
but better.
I mean, and mm-hmm. I think I think people see their way through pedestrian revivals of things, even mm-hmm. people who haven't seen the play before. And what's most exciting is when that's not the case.
Because it means something to the people who are saying it, who are
right.
doing it. Yeah.
If you look at one of the very best shows of the year, in my mind, Chicago, is David Cromer's production of Our Town at the
yes.
Hypocrites, which I thought was brilliant. And, you know, it was Our Town.
Right.
But I mean, Cromer had a point of view. And that
yeah.
was it.
Yeah. And one amazing moment in that production that we'll all remember forever.
Sometimes the very presence of certain people in the cast will provide something of a point of view or refresh it. Like the Virginia Woolf that had Kathleen Turner, and I'm blanking on the person I really admire.
Bill Irwin.
Bill Irwin.
Right, Bill Irwin. I mean, just the fact that Bill Irwin comes out of a clown tradition,
mm-hmm.
you know, transformed that play.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. That makes me think of a story I heard about when the Cat in the Hat had been just dying in one off-Broadway place after another, out of New York, and finally got to New York and was slammed, and the cast were so bummed, and it was hard to go in every day and do the show. And then Rosie O'Donnell came into the show, and the audience was just wildly excited by that. And the show was better. I mean, in some way, some objective way, the show was better because the audience thought it was better. I think that's a pretty interesting two-way.
Well, people relax when they think it's good. You know, I've seen mm-hmm. that. It's like if you watch a show, I remember this performance artist I used to review in Ohio who, and I knew this guy and I saw a lot of his work, and I would watch it. He would do something that the audience couldn't do about a third of the way into the show. And the first third, people would be tense and the room would be tense. And the moment he'd done this juggling thing, which he thought was the least interesting thing he did. But after he'd done that, people were like, okay, it's worth the money. I can sit down now and
uh-huh.
I can relax. So I think that people do relax. You know, other things are shows change every night. And I find that all the time. I've been back to shows and they're totally different.
Mm-hmm.
So the shows change every night, and often a review does not apply when you see the show.
Well, and if you can change, I mean, again, like after the reviews for August, Osage County, everybody came with certain expectations that may have cut either way. Either they were disappointed because they were expecting to see something huge and that didn't happen for them, or they were enthusiastic because they'd been told to be. And
yeah.
then that affects how the show plays
right.
out.
That's the beauty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think in the particular instance of August Osage County, too, there's a tremendous, you know, very complex set of prompts, you know, which are, some of them are in the play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that the play references a whole strain of American theater that's, you know, that most people seem to have forgotten about, or that's been become institutionalized, you know.
Talking about O'Neill or specifically?
O'Neill, yeah, mm-hmm. Things like that, mm-hmm. William Ng. All that has played on the way it's been received, both positively and negatively. Mm-hmm. You know, some the I was just looking at Hilton Knowles's review in the New Yorker, where he actually, you know, it's been villainized, that review, but it's an honest and you know, very well done review, but it places this August Osage County in a regional tradition.
Context, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
specifically, I haven't read it, talking about the specifically the Midwest, Chicago.
Provincial did come up as an adjective.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there, yeah. Right? Nice. Yeah.
Provincial playwright, I think, is what he called Tracy Lutz.
He was a provincial playwright, But he, I think, people react both positively. I think a lot of people, when they saw that play, they said to themselves, thank God somebody did something like that. Something that's meat and potatoes that I can understand, that has people like ripping at each other, uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. And in the good old American tradition. And this is something that, you know, I recognize. And other people saying, oh my God, this is a play, you know, I thought we were done with this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are just so many little countervailing and prompts that are being
affecting the audience's experience. Yeah, right.
I think audiences, I perhaps I'm wrong on this, but I do think audiences are a little more taken aback when they see bad theater than when they see a bad movie, for example.
Yes.
I mean, I have friends who are very culturally aware, and they're very picky about what they will go and see in the theater. And it's not just because of money, but they will go see almost anything in the movie theater. Just, let's just go see a film, because right. That's just entertainment. That's just relax, kick back, and the air conditioning or whatever. Mm-hmm. Where with theater, they have a little bit more of a, am I going to like this? Should I go see this? Because I think the fear is that it's happening right in front of them. The thing that makes theater so wonderful, the intimacy, the liveness, can quickly become a debit when you don't like it, and you are sitting there and these actors are doing their best and it just isn't good enough, or it's in service to a script that is just makes you cringe. And where do you look and what do you do? And particularly when they're 5 feet away from you, it can become a very uncomfortable experience. And I think that's even more than the money factor with theater. I think that's something that keeps people who might otherwise be inclined to see it a little, you know, and that's where we come in, I hope, to say we can steer them away from those things that are going to
be painful,
make them uncomfortable.
The probability of being bored is high in theater, much higher than in many other art forms.
At the same time, I think people really want to like a show.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Any show they go to, they're going to want to like it. And the more it costs, the more they're going to want
to
like
it. Yes, right. $100 a ticket, standing ovation. Right. Well, what that raises for me is the question of, it feels to me when I go to a show and I see an actor just be so wonderful that this is objective. This was good acting. This is a fact. And then I talk to someone else who didn't notice or thought the opposite. And I just wonder what each of you thinks about the question of, is there any objective reality to these aesthetic judgments that you are making? Chris?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I don't think it's just a matter of opinion. I think if I look back at my reviews, for example, there are reviews that I think I got right, and there are reviews that I think I got wrong. And that's probably a little more absolute than it really is, but I do think that. And I think good critics will mostly agree on things, because ideally you're not imposing your own standards on it. You're looking at, you know, it's that old adage of what were the artist is trying to do and how well do they do it and was it worth it and all the rest of it. And you're starting with what they're doing. And I think, you know, that if the Chrome is Our Town, I think if you didn't like that show, if you thought that was worthless, you're an idiot. I mean, I don't think it's a matter of opinion. I think it was just a very good theater. Now, obviously, these are shades. And I think, too, the ascribing of praise and blame is very difficult. That I think the best critics are able to look at a show and say, okay, that was well-directed, that was not well-directed, right. That was a matter of a performance, that's a problem coming from the play. And that's the hardest aspect of the job, is the analysis, not the sort of, you know, whenever I talk to young critics, they often sort of say that they'll often have opinions, but they won't always be able to justify them all that well. Mm-hmm. So I think that I do think in general there are skills that can be learned. I think truth is truth when it's, you know, and fakery is fakery. And I think, you know, if you see enough shows and you learn to spot that. And I don't think it is merely a matter of opinion. I think there is skill to the job.
Well, when you talked about shows that you feel you got wrong,
yes.
How do you revise your opinion retroactively? What happened that you now look back and say, I missed that?
Well, I think often you let yourself get compromised by factors that you should not. Like, I think that ultimately, you know, if I could put something above my computer, it would say, am I saying what I really think?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the key. You say what you really think. And often that's hard when you're in my seat because, you know, you're sparing people's feelings, say, or you've got an eye on some other factor, or the New York producers, or whatever. But usually when you let that stuff intrude, the review suffers.
Mm-hmm.
You have to simply respond to it as you truthfully see it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hardest part, and that's the only way to do it well.
I think the hard thing, particularly with writing the short reviews that we have at The Reader, is deciding what not to talk about. It's really not easier to write short. It's much harder, I find. And I don't think I still think I'm trying to find my way into that form.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there are definitely aspects of performances and design work and lots of other aspects of shows that just never make it into a review that in retrospect I might think, I really wished I'd mentioned that because it was actually a very stunning moment, but it just didn't seem to fit with whatever...
Literarily,
yeah,
almost, yeah.
With whatever thesis I'm trying to establish right. in 125 words,
right.
You know. So those are certainly regrets that I have. And I think there are, yeah, definitely. I think there are shows that I, you know, on repeat viewing will say, oh, you know, this is actually a much better script than I credited. Or
mm-hmm.
yeah, I still may not like the script, but I can understand why in the right hands it's a show that people do. And if they can do it well, then there is value to that.
Right. Maybe it's got some great part for an
actor. Yeah,
and
that's also very exciting. I mean, it's exciting as seeing, you know, a classic with a new moment in it, or you know, I think Cromer's Our Town is a perfect example. And actually, he did a Siegel several years ago that had a similar effect on me. Is seeing something that I've never really particularly liked. An example that comes to mind is Hurly Burly by David Rabe. I've just never really seen the appeal of that play. I've seen several productions. Gift Theater in Jefferson Park did a production, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, with just an astounding ensemble. And I was just riveted.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the play became that much better to me, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just hadn't seen the right actors tackle it. So it's, you know, but then when I go back and read it, I'm still thinking,
they just
no,
made more
I don't
of
really
it
like
it
this.
Right, right.
So.
It looked like you were going to say something more about that.
About the,
well, the question of, yeah, of getting it right.
Well, I just, you know, I mean, I think that you've got to just, I don't know. I do believe there are reviews where I can look back on now and think that the opinion was correct, and there are reviews where I can't. Now, that doesn't mean those are the most successful shows, because sometimes, you know. But, I mean, I think if you want one where I think I got it right, I think when I sat down at August Osage County, I thought to myself, this is a great American play that will do really well on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
period. And it was immediately obvious to me. That's, I just thought it was obvious. It was a great American play. Now, not everybody's agreed with that.
Right.
But that's what I thought, and I you know, stand by that. And then there are other shows that I've, you know, overpraised, because you can get carried away in a moment and you can think that something has more lasting significance than it ultimately
mm-hmm.
turns out to have. And then there are things where you don't like something, say, and you come to think that it was probably more sincere than you first realized mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
Well, it raises a fascinating question to me, which is just taste. What is it to have good taste? Presumably that is an important quality in a good reviewer, discernment. What is that exactly?
I mean,
where does it come from?
I don't know. It's that's a tricky one, because you know, you don't want to. I think if I were to say I don't like musicals, which I'm not saying, but if I were to say that, you would legitimately be angry if I then showed up to review your musical.
Right.
So I don't think it's about ascribing taste to the extent that, you know, the theater community in Chicago, one of the things that drives me the most crazy about it at times is the, it's constantly, certain members of it are constantly seeing enemies within it. You know, a different kind of theater is, I mean, it's just absolute nonsense in a, particularly in a pond as small as this ultimately. And I really vehemently resist that. And I try to see there is value and worth in often in the tiniest storefront, and there is value and worth to somebody who comes together at Mamma Mia for the eighth time. That there's still, those are not, you know, that there is worth to be had in all of those if the show is done well.
Right, it's good.
That's the key criteria. Is the show done well? So it's not about, now on the other hand, there is the tacky that you have to repudiate. There is the sloppy. There is the crass. All of that. I suppose that's taste. So to that degree, I embrace taste. But I don't have preferences, I like to think.
When I teach criticism, I teach it basically as a skill that involves seeing. I mean, that you see with as much clarity as you can. The basic exercise that I teach is something that I learned in a poetry workshop, which is you take an object and you observe it and you have to write about it without the use of adjectives. So you can't call it pretty. You can't call it big. You can't call it small. You just have to look at that thing and really figure out what it is. Yeah. And I think that's the basic skill that a critic should cultivate, is looking at a thing and seeing, to the best of your ability, what it is.
I think maybe there's another element, which is, and this is what Chris was talking about, which is being honest with yourself about what you felt, not trying to be smarter, you know, oh, I should have gotten that. So you talk yourself into having experience. I'm talking now as an audience member, not as a critic, but I know that if I go in with certain expectations, or if I want to feel smart, I may not be willing to just say, you know, I didn't get that. And that maybe was me, but maybe it was the show. Or I'm not articulating this very, very well, but some need to not be second-guessing yourself or straining to have a particular reaction to something. You just had the reaction you had, for whatever that's worth.
No, you can't help it.
Right, right. But then being able to, I guess the trick then is to put that on paper in a way that communicates.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes you get critics, the insecurity of the critic is often being out of the mainstream, right? That, you know, that I go review a Broadway opening and, of course, the danger is that you don't want to love something that everybody else is going to hate, and hates, and everybody's going to love because you look like a fool. But really, you shouldn't repress that. You just got to, you know, you just got to do that. Be true to yourself. Similarly, what happens sometimes is you find people review the reviews. So this happens if you're a daily critic a lot, that you find that people writing later about the show are reviewing your review as much as they are the actual show itself.
Yeah.
Now, on some levels, you know, that drives me crazy, and I think it's a bad idea 99% of the time. Although, on the other hand, sometimes the idea of Uber text or something, right? That sometimes the response to a show becomes part of the show itself. So, legitimately, if you're a cultural critic, you're writing about the hype, because it's hard to separate the hype from the text, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think in general, that's all to be avoided. In general, the best reviews are just honest responses.
Well, I think this idea of context is really interesting to me, that, you know, you go to a storefront theater where you know the resources are very small. I assume that informs how you respond to it. And I know I've had the experience you were talking about, I think it was Carrie, where you see a show in a venue that's maybe too big and too important for a kind of small but lovely play, and you're maybe too far away from it to get that intimacy or whatever. So going back to the first part of that, how do you essentially grade on the curve, so to speak, when you go to a small theater and they're doing a lot with a little, but in kind of absolute terms, it may not be everything that it could be? Anybody want to grab that one?
Well, I'm thinking about it from the other end of it, actually, which is that I tend to be more disappointed if I go to a theater like Steppenwolf or Goodman, and then they're doing work that feels not only like it lacks a point of view, but is also perhaps with some of the performances or some of the elements a little, I don't know if I want to say indifferently rendered, but that it's just not lighting it on fire, because I feel like that's their job. They're nonprofit theaters. They, everyone involved has this as their mission, as opposed to a storefront theater where I know everyone on that stage is probably working a day job, rehearsing right. in their spare time. And that doesn't mean that I give them a pass for bad work. But I think it's more annoying, I guess, sometimes in a larger theater.
Right.
Come on, you guys, you've been doing this for how long? This is your day job. And you know, what you sort of just start wondering, where did the wheels start coming off and why didn't anybody notice?
And it's, you know, you're allowed to be ambivalent mm-hmm. about a show. I just saw a production of Margaret Fleming, mm-hmm. which was, I'd never heard of until they'd done this, which was, first of all, a service to it. And obviously the piece is dated now. But they did a lot of smart things with it. You know, you don't have to measure these things. It seems like some of the assumption is that we have to do this in absolute terms, and we don't.
And I think one of the things that's a great advantage, though, in Chicago is that we do get to see children's theater. We do get to review improv. When I lived in the Bay Area, these things were invisible. It didn't mean that people weren't doing those things, partly because they don't have any institution like Second City, you know, comparable. But I would talk to critics there who just, oh, I don't want to review sketch comedy. Mm-hmm. And it was as if that was, you know, the redheaded stepchild of the theater world. And they would, you know, they'd get cooties if they stepped into a sketch comedy show. And I do think there's a great sort of kind of democratic, you know, eclectic approach to covering theater here, where I don't think anyone feels that, you know, certain shows are beneath me to see.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. That raises an interesting point. I was talking to a critic in New York whom I admire very much. This is Martin Denton, who has a website called nytheater.com. And he was saying that he sometimes is just amazed at seeing a review in a major publication that's talking about something as so avant-garde and so cutting edge. And he's saying, this is what I see every night as I go out into the true fringe of the New York theater. And some of the critics who see the more mainstream theater haven't seen it. They think it's new. And in fact, it's a very, you know, old hat from the point of view of someone sees the fringe theater. So you're saying in Chicago, that's less likely to happen because everybody's seeing some of everything.
I think so. Yeah. Even at the Daily, certainly, you know, mm-hmm. Chris sees, you know, sketch comedy too. And, mm-hmm. Yeah. Perhaps Nina and I tend, because of the designation on the fringe, are tending to see a little bit more of maybe the late night stuff or the, you know,
because you don't have
more
children.
Storefront. Yeah. I don't have kids. That helps. But I certainly don't feel like there's any kind of, you know, caste system involved
right.
With that.
Right.
Well, that's really one of the great things about Chicago theater. We never had that. Never. I mean, there's no Broadway, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway. Right. It never has been.
Right.
I mean, they're just, you know, it's always been, that's what it's always been. And even what we think of here is, some people say, you know, I remember writing something about how, I was calling some theater in town a small theater, and somebody took me to task for saying, well, they're not really small because I'm so much smaller. And in fact, when you really look at them, they have a staff of two.
Right.
You know, and so it's just, in some ways, the core of the mainstream of Chicago is small theater. Mm, it is.
Right.
In the great scheme of things.
And it's an embraceable size. I mean, almost anybody can get a flavor for all of it, which is impossible,
yes.
Probably in a place like New York, where.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of shows, though. I mean, that's true, but it's that you cannot see everything anymore.
Right.
You just can't. I mean, I think probably Tony's been around longer than me, but I'd imagine in the 80s, say, you could probably see almost everything, right, Tony? And now you can't.
I sure made an effort.
Also,
I don't know if I
succeeded. Right?
Well, I had children at the time, too, yeah.
Well, that raises a question I'm interested in, which is, do you see trends? As someone who's seen a ton of theater over a long time in Chicago, you know, what changes do you see in either what people are interested in putting on or how well they do it? Or is there anything you can sum up about?
You know, one of the things about the structure of Chicago theater is that it's fed by schools.
Mm.
And so a lot of what you might have seen, you know, how long ago is it? You know, 25 years ago, will be similar to what you're seeing now because, you know, the people are perpetually at a certain level, the people are perpetually in their 20s. What is interesting now, though, is that some of the people that were in their 20s in the 80s are now in their, you know, approaching their 50s. I wrote about this when the reader had the Best of Chicago issue, and I was asked to do, you know, Best Actor, which is ridiculous.
Right.
You know?
That is ridiculous.
For me, it was an occasion to write about, there are lots of best actors in Chicago. But the ones I wanted to focus on were these people who were getting this amazing second wind. Mm-hmm. And they were Larry Yando, Ross Lehman, and John Mahoney, all of whom I'd seen in shows that season, who were having a flowering and mm-hmm. were going to a completely new level of profundity.
Was that As You Like It for Yando?
As You Like It.
Yeah, that was fabulous.
The Comedy of Errors with Ross Lehman, mm-hmm. and there was that Larry Gelbart.
Better Late.
Better Late, yes, mm-hmm. which I didn't like the play, but I thought, like, you know, I'm sitting there thinking John Mahoney is afraid of nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so I was, you know, that is something that's happening now that I, you know, wasn't so available when I started writing.
We have this generation now, these later generations.
Right. But I think there's also a lot of support from, you know, I don't, talking about the caste system in reviewing, I don't think that there is a caste system in theater artists as much here mm-hmm. as perhaps there are other places. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned Larry Yando. I just read that he's a text coach for theater hikes. I think they're Taming of the Shrew. I mean, so they help. There's a way in which smaller companies will get, you know, an actor who maybe was last at the Goodman and is now coming in on, their one equity contract for that production to be at their 50-seat storefront or whatever it is.
Right, right.
And no one seems to think that this is remarkable, and I think that that's great, that there doesn't seem to be, I mean, certainly there are, you know, the contractual, you know, arrangements with equity, and not everyone can do everything at every theater, but no one seems to feel like performing at a smaller theater is somehow, you know, a come down.
Slumming it.
Yeah,
right.
That they're slumming it, or, I'm just helping the kids out. I mean, I don't get that sense of condescension.
Because we really
from the
that.
Artists themselves.
Right.
And another thing that's happening is the theaters that have become institutional are making a room in their institution for younger.
So Steppenwolf sponsoring other companies at Garage.
We've got Sean Graney coming in to do, the Hairy Ape? Is he doing it at the O'Neill Festival, the Goodman? Graney's directing something mm-hmm. in that, isn't he? Yeah. So, mm-hmm. which is terrific.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard storefront artists talk about how grateful they are to, for instance, Martha Levy, who turns up everywhere, you know, and sees her job as being much more than just to run Steppenwolf, but to kind of be a grand dame of the theater scene in general, I think. Well, I think we need to wind down, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.